You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Kent Carroll, the former editor-in-chief of Grove Press and the co-founder, publisher, and editor-in-chief of Carroll and Graff, and the publisher of Europa Editions, is my guest, along with author Jody Blanco, who is a well-known anti-bullying activist and the author of the New York Times bestseller, Please Stop Laughing at Me, One Woman's Inspirational Story, and several other books. Kent Carroll and Jody Blanco have collaborated on a book about John Kennedy Toole, whose posthumously published novel, A Confederacy of Dunces, won the Pulitzer Prize. The book Jody Blanco and Kent Carroll have written is itself a novel and is called I, John Kennedy Toole. Kent Carroll and Jody Blanco, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hi, we're delighted to be here.
Yes, indeed.
So how did your collaboration come to be?
Well, I started out with the idea of, I had been involved in the book being published initially, and a number of years went by, and there were three or four different people that came to me about the idea of writing a book about it. And the initial idea was just to do a straightforward story about his life and times and my involvement with it. And there was at least one major agent who was very excited by that. I thought that would be worth a great deal of money. And I did some research, and it became clear to me that there just wasn't enough interesting, good material there. And at that point, or shortly thereafter, Jody and I, who had worked together before, we had done a biography of famous, nasty movie star years before. And so I trusted her. I'd known her for a long time. I'd known her for 25 years. We'd worked together early on when I was at Carolyn Graff, and she was doing publicity for me. And so we talked about the possibility of it, and she was excited. And we decided that a novel, a nonfiction novel, a mix of the two, was the only real way that we could explore the depths of this and be honest to who he was and how this happened. And indeed talk about the way it happened, because much of that was really quite interesting. And so we decided to do it. And the people that I knew who had been very interested in doing just doing a history, a straight history of it, were not interested in pursuing with this, not interested in deciding to sell it. And so we got a publisher who had worked for me some years ago, Claiborne Hancock, and he was a fan. And he had a new publishing company that was very successful, and we liked him, and he knew and respected Jody. And so we decided to work with him. And that decision then occupied about 4.5 years of our lives.
And I want to jump in here too, Gary, is that one of the things we wanted to do is tell a story in a reimagined way. Because the narrative arc of what actually happened to Kenny Toole, from when he conceptualized the book to his death, to his mother championing it and making it a reality, all of those aspects, they've been told before in various history books, they've been sort of alluded to in articles, but we wanted to reimagine the story. We wanted to tell it the way he might have told it if he were still alive. So we immersed ourselves in research. So for 3 years, I mean, we scoured the archives at Tulane. Everything that Kenny ever wrote that exists on paper, whether it's a recipe, a note to himself, or his fifth grade math notebook, we've read every page. We've gone through it. All of the characters in the book, everything emanates from fact. Even his love interest in the book, that was kind of an exciting thing to find. We were going through the archives, and there was a single letter in the archives at Tulane, a passionate sort of cryptic letter from a young girl saying how much she missed him. And it was clearly erotic. And we looked and we couldn't find anything else from her. And we thought, okay, there was a muse. And so all of those different aspects kind of went into this, and doing it as a novel gave us the freedom to tell a good story, I think, with more humanity to it.
So you did the same kinds of research that you would do if you were writing a biography.
More stringent, or as stringent at least, because we knew we would be held to this. We knew we were going to be held to an exhausting standard, because the people who are fans of the Confederacy of Dunces and John Kennedy Toole, they're super fans. They're exacting. So we did research, and then Kent found researchers to vet what we did to make sure that it was accurate. So yes,
Don. There were also some gaps. I mean, there were things that were never there that laid out clearly that we had to interpret. And I think we did, and that was one of the things I think we did very well. I mean, it was very important to us that this be honest. And this is, we don't know everything about what went on in those days or that place that he went to or those people he was with, but we knew enough about him that we could talk about it in ways that were fair and honest and also in many cases exciting.
You know, Kent makes a good point. Those gaps, like you'd be surprised. The gaps were things like his death certificate. Okay, the coroner's report was destroyed in a fire, and that kind of documentation is what was lost. You know, a suicide note was never found, but there are many people who believe that there was one. A lot of people believe that there is a lost manuscript, that he was working on another book before he died. So these are things that we reimagined, but they didn't just emanate from our imaginations. The kernel of these things emanated from research. And we also spent, or I spent, a long weekend with Kenny's best friend, who's actually a character in the book, Joel Fletcher, and just sort of talking with him on a human level, why he missed his buddy and his recollections of Kenny as a person, as a buddy. And that kind of work, Kent, of course, was there. I mean, he's the publisher that championed A Confederacy of Dunces and got it to where it went. And so we took research, Kent's experiences, and literally try to tell this story, like I said, as Kenny might have. And maybe he did.
Well, let me ask this. What percentage of your story is not, I don't want to say made up, but conjecture?
20%, perhaps?
Yeah, I would say the bones, the blood, and the veins are fact, but some of the cosmetics are reimagined.
Now, I'm curious, if you're writing a novel, and I count two of you, so how did you divide the work? How do two people write one novel? What's that like?
Well, it went back and forth, and we did it chapter by chapter. And we'd have an outline of what it was, and we'd talk about what that chapter was, and then Jody would do a first draft, and then I would do the second draft, and then she would read what changes I had made. And sometimes that could take months because we were very busy doing other things and we were in different places. And invariably, we had to go back to each time we had something that we thought was good, but not good enough. And we'd go back and redo it. And I would think that almost every chapter, we probably changed dramatically over the course of the three or four rewrites. And some of the things that were added into it, which really was Jody's idea, were all these the recognitions of the time and place. So you knew something that was going on in the world. And I thought that was a very good idea.
Oh, yes. Every once in a while, you tell me, Princess Grace, Princess Diana was married.
But also we had
Muhammad Ali won the title. Yeah.
And we had time. And we started off doing it. It would headline each section. And then later we broke it up and it was in different parts in the book. It worked. It worked itself into it because we had that time, and we were willing to take the time and the effort to rewrite because we thought it was very important.
And I found that, excuse me one sec, I found that really interesting, the way you picked certain things to tell me about. Were those things that you thought John Kennedy Toole would have been interested in, or you just wanted to place them, or what? Yeah.
Both. I mean, we wanted to, for the, I call them the markers, you know, the time and place markers. We wanted them to be sort of a broad spectrum so that the person reading the book, if they were old enough, if they were alive then, they would say, oh, right, I remember that. So it would be sort of visceral for the reader. That was one. And the other thing I wanted to mention about Kent's and my collaborative process, and I say this with such nostalgia and affection, my favorite part of writing this book by far, and Kent and I have written other books together. We've done a lot together. He taught me how to write. I would be a deaf mute without Kent Carroll. We've been friends since I graduated college and I'm 56. He taught me how to write and he taught me how to read, if that makes any sense. And so I get, you know, we talk about the chapter, as he said, I do the chapter, I give it to him, then he would give me his changes, but we would always, we do something very few editors and writers do. We would have that phone call. So he would give me the first round of changes over the phone. Then we'd discuss it. Then I'd send to him. Then he'd do more rewrites. And it was like this wonderful dance between father and daughter. And my favorite moments is when he would give me his changes or his rewrites, because they would awaken the text. They would awaken the book. And I could feel the chapter waking up, opening its eyes as Kent infused his portion of the writing into it. It was
and it also turned amazing. Into it turned into the perfect way to fill in the blanks, because what we were doing is we were finding out more and more about him and the history and the background. And so we had the sense of responsibility, and there was a point at which we felt we have done this properly, and that was important.
Huh. Yeah, I nearly had a heart attack getting there, but yeah.
Well, it's interesting, you know. You were saying, Jody, that the fans of this book are legion and devoted. And Kent Carroll, you'd think there would be enough just in telling the life story. So when you were saying that there wasn't enough there and that you decided to go for a novel, what kinds of things were missing in the biography of John Kennedy Toole, or that you were able to discover that you needed more?
His internal life.
Yeah.
His internal life. The external sort of scaffolding of his life and the backstory of a Confederacy of Dunces, the scaffolding was there. And there are other great books that have that scaffolding.
We also, we invented, you know, the character who actually is based on somebody I knew who grew up in Minneapolis and used to talk it that way and was worked in New York. And it was, we needed a character to fill in all those spaces, what was going on in the world. And this guy turned out to be a terrific character, in large part because I could draw on somebody I knew and liked and had been, you know, had a close friend with for 10 years. And unfortunately, he was, you know, he was dead by then, but he was the perfect person to pull in and do that, because he had that way of thinking about things.
And we modeled the character of Professor Bell, that character's mentor, after my favorite literature professor at NYU. So they were sort of modeled after people we admired.
And you also have a character who is a character in A Confederacy of Dunces that lives in your novel.
Ignatius Riley. Yeah. That was scary doing that. I don't know that I could write my own name without Kent. I don't know that I could. because that was an idea that we talked about and we hatched, and we would spend like, you know, we would spend chunks of time together and just hang out and talk. You know, it really is sort of like a father-daughter collaboration, and I'm absolutely, you know, the protege here, right? And he's the mentor. So we talked about that, and I'm like, it just feels right. And he kind of looked at me and says, you know, that can be very tricky. I said, I know, but we can do it. We can do it. And I was so happy when Kent not only embraced that idea, but then he took it and he refined it, and oh, he made it smoking hot. I mean, that's Kent's genius, is that he can wake up a page with editorial and narrative insights that it just, it's so exciting. It's like putting makeup on, you know, it's exciting. He's amazing. And that's where that came from, was,
Jody, that's lovely. You earned your $5.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with Kent Carroll and Jody Blanco. They're the authors of a novel called I, John Kennedy Toole, a novel based on a true story. It's about the life of author John Kennedy Toole, whose posthumously published novel, A Confederacy of Dunces, was a huge hit and won a Pulitzer Prize.
Let's talk a little bit about A Confederacy of Dunces, and I'm sure there are listeners who haven't read it or don't know anything about it. And I guess it's most famous because it was published posthumously and then won the Pulitzer Prize. I think that was the first time that had ever happened.
It was published 10 years after it was written. And I believe, and I think it's clear, had it been published that 10 years before, I don't think it would have found an audience. The world had changed in those 10 years, particularly with young men. And there was a possibility, and the world was different in terms of the music, in terms of the sexuality, I mean, the way people got involved, the travel. It was very different. We'd gone through Woodstock, lots of things had happened. And the story is, I had bought a book and published it from Louisiana State University Press. And then they asked me about this book that they had from this odd fellow that they knew. And I didn't think there was any possibility the way they explained it, but they sent it to me and I read it and I thought it was really quite dramatic and wonderful and we could do something with it. And I was at Grove Press at the time. And it was the perfect publisher to do that because we were known for doing unusual different books that became very successful. So it was a nice mix. And when I found out, I read it and I liked it, I then discovered that they were publishing it, but they hadn't done anything. It wasn't in their catalog. They had, I think, 200 copies that had been sent out to bookstores. And so I thought, I've got to get involved with this. And so essentially I took over. I got their information. I got their material. I got a lot of the things I could send out and started to go out to people who I knew and worked with regularly. And it began. There were a few early reviews that were excellent and it just built upon itself. But my engagement with it, the people at Louisiana State University Press were not very happy, in part because I was the one who contacted the people who were writing the reviews at the Washington Post and the New York Times, all these places, and they started to call it a Grove Press book. Oh. And by this time, it was becoming an important book, and they wanted, you know, they wanted to take the credit for it. But unfairly, I suppose, the credit was going to Grove Press and me.
Because you guys had done the work to get the book out there.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I want to ask you, Kent Carroll, about Grove Press and the years that you were there. It is a marvelous imprint, and some of the greatest books of the 1960s and 70s were published.
Yes, indeed.
And they were controversial books. Did you have a lot of problems? Pornography or charges of that nature and some of the stuff that you were publishing?
Well, that was it's early on. There was a lot of problems. I mean, Barney Rossett, that owned the company, was quite a remarkable fellow. And the books, Henry Miller, people that sort of books that had a certain kind of sexuality, Grove was sued, I think, 4 times. Hmm. And they went to court. One of those to the highest court in the land. And it turned over censorship in the United States. I mean, before that, books that came in from, say, France that went through coming into New York, the people who ran those little outfits, they could say this, they could take it out and say, you can't have this. There's something wrong with this book. It was really kind of nutty. And what Grove did is it was willing to take a chance on losing his company to have those, to say, we're going to publish this and then go ahead and publish it and then stand up, for the attempt to have it stopped. And that was, for a number of years, Grove had was in control of that. They did more than anything else. And by the time I got there in the early 70s, things had started to slip and slide a little bit. And because of what Grove did, books that could not have been published in America before, you now could publish. And so Random House and some of the big companies said, now we don't have to worry about being in trouble. We can take what Grove has done, but we'll pay a lot more for it. And so our ability to continue receded in ways that were sort of sad.
Do you think that books like, Fear of Flying and things like that owe a debt to Grove Press then?
I think a lot of the books did. I mean, what it did, it said anything was open, anything was possible. And a lot of people came in, and particularly a lot of women started to write interesting things that they hadn't done before. And also it was a time in which the world was changing. I mean, as I said before, that the music and what you saw in the movies and the kind of romances people had, and it was much more attuned to that. And there was an audience that very often wanted something that was sexy and, had been banned somewhere. And it was sort of exciting to do that. But amongst that, there were lots of wonderful writers also. And, and I worked with Henry Miller and Norman Mailer and, a whole bunch of people that we still had contact with and we were able to do, publish books with.
Why do you think there was this breaking down of the Puritan ethic in America? Do you think it was a generational thing? Why did it begin to unravel in the 60s?
Because I think before that, beginning in the 50s and going into the 60s, a couple of things happened. One was intelligent, smart young women from middle-class families went to college. Before that, they didn't. They went to two-year colleges. They were going to be teachers. They were going to do something of that sort. When I went to college in New Jersey, it was all male. In most of those Ivy League schools, they were all male. And by that time, it started to shift. And I think the fact that women were involved made a big difference. But I also think the fact that it was the country as a whole, there was just, there was a lot of money. People could travel. They could go out and they could do things. I mean, you could take your summer vacation and go to France for a month. And the air flight and the cost of staying in France, you could do that for a few hundred dollars. And all of these possibilities then were there. And one thing led to another. But I think things like Woodstock, Woodstock was really quite remarkable what went on there. I mean, I was involved with that peripherally also. But the fact that 400,000 people could sit out in the rain and the mud and be kind to one another, that 400,000 people, nobody got shot, nobody had anything stolen. It really had shifted. It was a different world that happened. And so these things were available in ways that they simply had not been before.
And so you think that those changes set the table for a Confederacy of Dunces, so to speak?
Confederacy of Dunces was so odd that I don't think it fits in an unusual way. I think what happened was that nobody expected it would have the success that it did. But one of the things that I discovered early on is that it was being bought by young men. And new fiction by young men, there wasn't a lot of that. And there was, they saw something in that. And he represented something that they thought was important. He represented something, you know, that the music of the day represented. There was a kind of freedom attached to it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I wanted to jump in, is that I think that we one of the things we wanted to bring out in the book was the question of, had this book been published in 1964 when Kenny first submitted it, would it have had the same success it did being published when it did in 1981 or 80? We surmised no, it wouldn't. And we explored that whole theme so much of what was it about that character. And I think Kent nails it. It's freedom. The character of Ignatius Reilly represents freedom. And so capturing that and trying to capture the spirit of the 60s woman in Kenny's girlfriend, in I, John Kennedy Toole, trying to do all that, those were some of the things that we knew we couldn't do in nonfiction, that we could only tackle with grace in fiction. And, and Kent's recollections too of that period were so helpful, because I didn't even have to research any of that. I just talked to my friend.
Well, Jody Blanco, you're very prominent in the in your advocacy against, I don't know how to say it, in the bullying, in the mm-hmm. You're not for bullying, you're not trying
anti-bullying activist,
and how did that come about?
That's an interesting story. I was in the publishing industry for 20 years before that incarnation. I owned a PR firm and I specialized in book publicity and the entertainment business, and all the big publishers were my clients. And I was a bullied kid, and I just was that kid who was different, who didn't fit in because she was different. And I woke up at 2 a.m. and I had the idea, I'm going to write a book about my childhood, turn all that pain into purpose, and call it Please Stop Laughing at Me. 2 a.m. And I wrote it down on a shoebox next to my bed. And I called up Kent here, Carol, in the morning, and I said, what do you think about this idea? Now, bear in mind, this was before the anti-bullying movement. This was before the term bullying even existed as part of the cultural vernacular. He said, I think that's a great idea. I'll help you put together the proposal. And we did. So, and this was like this was right after Columbine. Bullying didn't even exist. No one even thought of it in those terms. And I approached every publisher and they all said, Jody, we love you. You've made us a lot of money, but bullying is a non-issue and there's no audience for this book. So I bullied a Boston publisher, Adams Media, which is now a subsidiary of Simon & Schuster. I can't avoid Simon & Schuster. Simon & Schuster is everywhere in my life. My first job out of college, they publish all my, it's a funny thing. Anyways. So they published it and I got my former bullies from school to agree to go on Good Morning America with me and apologize to me in front of the world.
The actual people who bullied you when you were a kid.
Yeah. From fifth grade through high school. Yeah. And the night before we were to appear on Good Morning America, it got canceled because Bush declared war in Iraq and all of my media got canceled. And they advanced something like thousands and thousands of books based on that appearance. And I didn't think anything would happen. And 3 days later, my publisher called me and said, congratulations, you're on the New York Times bestseller list. I heard you killed it on GMA. And I was stunned. And it was because of the title of the book and the cover that bullied kids saw themselves in it and parents saw their kids in it. And that book helped to start the anti-bullying movement in America. It was probably a key catalyst. And so when I wasn't working on I, John Kennedy Toole with Kent, I'm doing my other job, which is traveling the nation's schools, doing anti-bullying work as a professional speaker. And it's funny because Kent was there for that book too. I mean, it's that's one of the reasons we had the confidence to do this book, is because we've done so many books together. I mean, the movie star book, it just felt so right.
Tell him about the movie star.
Oh, yeah. Can I say his name?
Yes.
Or do I make him guess? How cruel. Okay, so my entertainment attorney is, I'll see if you can guess the movie star, is friends with this movie star who had a passionate, controversial, scandalous love affair with a famous pinup girl who wore a bathing suit, famous for her long blonde feathered hair and her bathing suit poster. And this poster adorned the bedroom wall of every prepubescent boy in America from 1976 to probably 1980.
And it's a purple bathing suit and she's angelic.
Correct. Good job. Yes, that's right.
They're awesome. I have the poster right over here.
All right. So my entertainment attorney, quite frankly, the funny story, he was on the phone. Ryan O'Neill is his client. And my entertainment attorney is taking me out to lunch in LA and suddenly he's in a crappy mood. I'm like, what is the matter? He said, oh, Ryan's upset. And I said, well, why is Ryan upset? And he said, well, he wants NBC to do another documentary on Farrah's death and they don't want to do it. And I said, that's because it's depressing and macabre. And he said, yes, but he wants to reinvigorate her legacy. And I said, if he wants to reinvigorate her legacy, it's simple. He needs to write a memoir of his love affair with her that begins the moment they met and ends the moment she died, so that America and the world can understand why they loved each other. So instead of everybody judging it, they'll be swept up in it. And he said, that's a great idea. Do you mind if I stop for gas? As he was pumping gas in his car, he handed me his cell phone and said, Ryan's on the phone, tell him your idea. That night I had dinner with Ryan O'Neill and he said, the only way he would do it is if I wrote the book. And I said, I can't, I'm on tour. You'll have to wait a year. He said, I'll wait. So I said, well, I'm not going to write it alone. I, Kent, Carol, and I will do it together. Kent's my other half, literally. And he said, fine. And I, what was like 2 or 3 days later, Kent was on a plane to Los Angeles. We were put up in Malibu Beach. We thought it was going to be this fabulous experience. And it turned out to be one of the most dramatically discomforting experiences of our lives. However, great cocktail party stories.
Well, what went wrong?
Ryan was...
part of it was he couldn't remember anything.
Yeah.
No, it's true. And he made a very good movie with Stanley Kubrick. And Kubrick had the reputation of having his actors do it over and over and over again. And Brian seemed to have wouldn't put up with that. So I asked him when Kubrick said that to him, what did you do? And he couldn't remember. So it went over again and again and again. There was something that we could have built into a nice, 5 or 6 or 7 pages. It just wasn't there. And what we put together was the best you could do, and it really was pretty good. And Simon & Schuster, SNS, published it.
Random House published it.
And yeah. It's sold. But working with him was not a pleasant experience.
Well, here's the thing. It was, I was able to extrapolate the information. But the challenge was, is that he has a very emotionally tempestuous relationship with his children. And we needed his children to contribute to the book. So inspiring their contribution took a lot of energy and acuity. And secondly, and this is funny, so if Ryan hears this, I hope he can laugh at himself, because I certainly...
I'm sure he listens to my program every
day. Never know. You're very swashbuckling.
Okay, now, enough.
So we had this junket, right? We had this junket. We had the publicity junket. And bear in mind, for 20 years, I was a publicist. So all these producers, Ken and I both know them. He was a publisher. He's a publisher. I was a publicist. So we knew all the media. So we had this huge junket that we did in tandem with Random House. We had the front page story in People Magazine, front full page story in USA Today, and they're hitting on the exact same day that he's supposed to do two segments with Matt Lauer on the Today Show. I mean, you know, the old-fashioned publishing that we all remember, when you did certain media, you had your advance orders out there and you knew the book was going to run. You'd chase it. So we're in the limo. Ryan, of course, brings a bodyguard, which Random House nor we could understand. We're in the limo. And Ryan says, hey, Jody, you know the producer, right? Why don't you get out of the car and let her know we're coming? And then he slams the door shut. He reaches over, slams the door shut, says to his driver, step on it. And they go peeling off into Manhattan. And the producer of the Today Show sees this. And she said, where's Ryan? I said, I have no idea. And I get a phone call from the driver that says, Ryan isn't in the mood. He's tired of talking about Farah. He needs a break. Meanwhile, this is two live segments on the Today Show. So the entire publicity campaign on that day wasn't about what was in the book, but about how Ryan O'Neill peeled off in a limo before his Today Show interview. So we laugh about it now, but yes, Ken and I have had some fabulous adventures together.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with Kent Carroll and Jody Blanco. They're the authors of a novel called I, John Kennedy Toole, a novel based on a true story. It's about the life of author John Kennedy Toole, whose posthumously published novel, A Confederacy of Dunces, was a huge hit and won a Pulitzer Prize.
So let's talk again a little bit more about this, about the Confederacy of Dunces. One of the things you talk about in the book is the fact that it's never been filmed or made into a film. Mm-hmm. And why do you think that is? And do you think that that will change?
It's not alone. I think Jody may remember this better than I, but there are a number of very good books that haven't been made. Plus the fact,
Rye.
Right. But in his case, there, starting with John Belushi, there were three or four people who wanted to do it, and they all died.
There's a curse, a Confederacy of Dunces curse?
I don't know. And there's still people who talk about it. But the fact is there were at least three major people, actors, starting with Belushi, who really wanted to make it. And before they could, they were deceased.
And I think part of it, you know, so many films were made into movies that theoretically should not have been. Breakfast at Tiffany's, Lucky Jim. As Kent once said, Lucky Jim was one unlucky bastard. so there were, you know, there have been films that probably would have been best served left alone as literary masterpieces. And A Confederacy of Dunces may be one of them. And when we were writing the book, you know, we had that in mind. We wanted to sort of explore that. And that's the other reason we did this in the format that we did it. We used narrative as a storytelling device because it allowed us to explore those really fun, interesting questions without being shackled by certain conventions.
Well, actually, I think that John Kennedy Toole would make a good movie.
Thank you. Say that loudly and light a candle for all to hear.
did you think about that, actually, when you were writing?
Every second. Every inch of every second, yes. And in fact...
Well, we thought about it, but we thought it was unlikely. Well, I thought it was unlikely.
Yes, but I'm young and idealistic.
Do you think that there is still, you probably know, what is the readership these days of A Confederacy of Dunces? Is it still in print? Has it been in print all this time?
Yes, it does. Grove Press still has Confederacy of Dunces, and they sell about 30,000 copies a year still. Hmm. And recently, about 6-9 months ago, it was on... It had got some attention in London, and on the major newspapers there, it was a bestseller again. So it sells regularly, and it has a regular audience.
And is it an ebook also from Grove Press? Can you get an ebook of?
Yes, I'm sure you can.
I own it in both forms.
Yes.
So always with me.
Yeah, it's in stores.
Did you both have to read the book, the novel, again a few times when you were working on this?
Yes.
Three times.
I've had to read it three times with a highlighter.
Well, you had to read it three times because you were writing a book about it. But do you think, how do you feel that the book stands up to repeated readings?
I think it does. And I think what you also have is a lot of people read it and tell other people about it. And one of the reasons it continues to sell, you know, is for that reason. But I think what happens to the people who read it, not all of them, of course, they identify with it. It's almost as if he's a friend. They encounter something, a way of looking at the world, how you can behave, what's really important, what you can laugh at, what's available out there, and a lot of that's quite private. And you can't talk to everybody about that. But, you know, I've known young men in particular where they've had a couple of glasses of beer and they're sitting at a table someplace and somebody brings it up. And then they talk about it for the next 2 hours.
And now, had there ever been a posthumous Pulitzer Prize before?
No.
No, it was the first. And in fact, we chatted with Jonathan Yardley, that's a kind of an interesting story because he was the chairman of the nominating committee for fiction that year. And so I met with him and Kent, and he had been friends for years. And I was expecting this big dramatic story, sort of like 12 Angry Men, you know, that lone juror. And Jonathan was like, it wasn't that dramatic. Actually, we all agreed. I'm like, okay, I need something dramatic. I thought, Jeff, give me something dramatic. He said, it wasn't. He said, the only thing that was dramatic really behind the scenes was we on the nominating committee positioning it in such a way to, you know, to the board, to the Pulitzer board, that they would actually follow through with giving a posthumous award because they'd never done that before. And it paved the way for other posthumous awards. I think one in music since, but yeah, that was Pardon?
I don't think for books there.
No, not for books. One, I think
it was the only time.
Yeah.
Now, the Pulitzer Prize is there's a cash award. So where did the money go?
That John Kennedy Toole's estate. And in fact, Thelma, his mother, you know, she would, at the time, it went to his estate. And she was an incredible character too. I mean, being able to balance her and, you know, that was another thing. The outside world sees Thelma Toole as a very sort of flat character. I mean, they see her as this overbearing mother, and it's a very sort of unidimensional depiction of her. And we wanted to use this form, like narrative novelese, we wanted to use this to give her some interior life and some interior sort of retrospection. Because we wanted her to be human. We wanted her to be someone, a mom who other moms might identify with at her worst and at her best. So that was another thing that was challenging for us to do. We spent a lot of time on that.
And she was strong. She came to New York after the Pulitzer Prize, and she was interviewed and she was on television. And she really held her own, and she was a smart woman and completely devoted to her son, and it was very effective.
Well, the journey of this book is a fascinating one, and you did a great job with this book. The book is called I, John Kennedy Toole, a novel based on a true story, and the authors, my guests, Kent Carroll and Jody Blanco. Thank you both for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
It was fun.
Indeed.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.